Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, a U.S. Army Combined Arms Center podcast on emerging doctrine and the Army's vision of warfare. Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Nate Rice, and this podcast topic is the role of protection in operations. We welcome Commander of the Maneuver Support Center of Excellence, Major General Christopher Beck, and Director of the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate, Colonel Retired Rich Creed. Welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Before we start diving into updates on ADP 3-37, I'd like to ask Colonel Retired Creed to frame the protection warfighting function for us.
Yeah, absolutely, Nate. So we'll start with joint doctrine, right? See, we want to stay nested inside of joint doctrine in each of the services. So joint doctrine, specifically joint publication 3-0, which is joint operations, defines protection as a preservation of effectiveness and survivability of mission-related military and non-military personnel, equipment, facilities, information, and infrastructure deployed or located within or outside the boundaries of a given operational area. So when we talk about protection as a warfighting function, we're looking at the related tasks, systems, and methods that prevent or mitigate detection by the enemy, the effects that the threat may be able to bring against us, and other hazards in order to preserve our combat power and enable our freedom of action. So we write doctrine so that forces can understand what it is they're expected to do and give them the things that they need to think about to prosecute operations directly, which is why, from an Army doctrine standpoint, our definition is probably more broadly applicable than the joint one, which is by necessity broader. When we talk about warfighting functions, there's an application to everybody. So it's not just protection people or maneuver people. So when we talk about maneuver, for example, sustainment units have to understand maneuver because they're helping to enable it. When we talk about protection, all the different types of formations in the Army need to understand protection, because if you think about protection as an outcome, then the way you do business, the things that you do, the times that you do them, the plans that you conceive, all need to have an appreciation for protection, just like they have to have an appreciation for sustainment or intelligence or fires. So we like to say, and General Beck and I have talked about this before, but if you think about protection as an outcome, it results from hundreds or even thousands of things that happen in a formation. You know, maybe hundreds in a platoon, thousands in a brigade combat team or a division. And it's all the different individuals in that organization doing the right things to the right standard at the right time. Because any one mistake could put the entire formation at risk.
That's a great comment, Rich. Protection is... the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. As Rich said, the reality is protection is everybody's responsibility. And I'll talk a little bit more later about some of the aspects of it. But the reality is it starts with a mindset. If everybody has the mindset of protection, starting with the most junior soldier at the individual level, all the way up through those senior formations, those higher level tactical formations, even operational level formations, then protection is leveraging all those capabilities simultaneously to create an outcome or an effect on the battlefield, as Rich described. So I appreciate your laydown. Very accurate.
Why are we talking about this now? Well, it's because the operational environment is a little different. The type of operations that the Army's got to prepare to do are a little bit different. It's not that we haven't always thought about protection, but I always like to push this cultural mindset idea, right? So we had a cultural mindset about protection in Afghanistan and Iraq or in the Balkans and other places. The difference, I think, is the threats, right? And so it's not that we're saying that people didn't know that this was important before, but the applicability or the application or the things that you do to create some level of protection, I just think are very different now.
I absolutely agree. And many senior leaders have said, ubiquitous sensing is a reality on today's battlefield. You're going to be seen everywhere. And protection, unlike it was in Afghanistan and Iraq, it has got to be across all domains. And so that mindset, that protecting yourself from that sensing is absolutely critical across all domains. And that's where we've evolved this concept of protection a little further in the last year or so that we hadn't previously.
ADP 3-37 was updated January 2024 to synchronize protection doctrine with FM 3.0 and multi-domain operations. One of the key changes was the addition of four task categories that organize the 16 protection tasks. The first category is protect capabilities, with the task of survivability, air and missile defense, CBRN operations, force health protection, physical security, and personal recovery. The second category is protect areas, with tasks of area security, anti-terrorism, explosive ordnance disposal, police operations, detention operations, and population and resource control. The third category is protect information, with the tasks of OPSEC, cybersecurity, and defense. And the final category is risk management, which includes only itself as a task. Sir, what are some of the key thoughts and concepts that drove the update to ADP 3-37?
So that's a great question. I think you talked about the categories, and I would even go a little further than that. So the categories were really to help commanders and staffs understand what we're saying. If you look in the manual, it's got 16 different pillars, lots of different tasks. And what happened, frankly, was folks would get overwhelmed because the breadth and depth of the requirements for protection just leads you to the point where you're saturated and you don't understand how to look at the problem. So these categories really helped us bend the problem a little bit. And some other things that we've really worked hard within this version of 3.37 is ensuring that everybody understands that protection is now throughout the depth and breadth of the battlefield. It's got to include actions in all domains, and it's got to include kinetic and non-kinetic capabilities. We are driving that very hard. I know it's one of the things that we're going to talk about a little bit later is how we've tried to take that definition. Again, in addition to the categories, we've tried to take the doctrinal definition, which hasn't changed and shouldn't, but we've tried to explain that in different terminology for commanders. In the introduction to 3.37, we don't use these words, but we talk about three different areas of protection. The first is really the Army Protection Program related to AR-525-2. And really, we have worked closely with the Provost Marshal General to ensure that they are the lead for a lot of that, because a lot of that is policy, a lot of that is driven maybe a little bit more toward home station, but that doesn't change the reality that the actions that they're taking, the actions derived from that AR, absolutely have to be synchronized across the entirety of the protection warfighting function. And then we've taken the function itself, the warfighting function, and looked at two different levels of tasks in addition to these categories, and that is foundational and operational. And again, we've learned a lot over the last year since we've written this ADP, so we're going to continue to evolve that. We've learned it because we've been out with units. We've been with MCTP. We've been to the CTCs. We've talked with units. We've got very good forums going on. And frankly, that discussion with the field is what's keeping our learning relevant so that we can feed that back to the force. Because, again, back to the discussion we were having before with Rich, so I'll start with the foundational. That starts with every soldier. The sergeant major of the Army routinely says we have to be brilliant at the basics. And that starts with every soldier understanding, how do you dig a fighting position? How do you do personal camouflage? How do you do camouflage of your vehicle? How do you do deception, dispersion? All those things that maybe during Iraq and Afghanistan we did, but we did in smaller segments or sections. And then it speeds up to operational protection. And that's where the discussions we've been having this week with Army senior leaders, it's the education of, I like to say, targeting is bullet going out, protection is bullet coming in. Operational protection is really the synchronization of non-kinetic assets throughout the depth and breadth of the battlefield to create convergence opportunities against the enemy, basically create multiple dilemmas. It allows us as a force, it's back to the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. We've got to be sure that we're taking all those kinetic and non-kinetic assets and synchronizing them at the right place and the right time on the battlefield against the right threat to protect the right activity. And if we do that, then we will create the outcome that we need to for our forces. Couldn't agree more. You cannot maneuver, you cannot sustain, you cannot fire unless you start with protection.
I think the other thing to bang the drum a little harder, sir, is one, all our doctrine gets informed by policy to a certain degree, right? I mean, if it wasn't informed by policy, it would be unrealistic. You'd be saying that you're going to want to do things that you're not even allowed to do, right? That's one. And then I think the other one To your point, with this feedback from the field over the last year, I mean, that's a palpable, tangible example of how doctrine contributes to transforming for the Army Chief of Staff's priorities, right? When doctrine is healthy, it's always in transformation and contact because we are responding to the realities of the operational environment, the experience, and the good ideas from the field. And if we weren't doing that, and we said, hey, we got this exactly right, then we're not adapting. And we kind of had our heads in the sand. And in some cases, in some areas, we probably have been that way, but this is not one of them.
I think that's a great comment. And I can even tie that back to the Harding Project from the CSA. The fact that we're getting feedback on 337 reinforces exactly what you just said. It means folks are reading it and they're challenging us. Hey, that makes sense. Hey, this doesn't make sense. But it keeps us relevant. It keeps us agile. And I couldn't agree more. That transform and contact, it's exactly what the generating the institutional force needs to be doing.
Protection as a warfighting function depends on the integration of tasks and capabilities across Army branches and compos, perhaps more than any of the other five warfighting functions. General Beck, what are some of the challenges you see with this diverse dynamic?
One of the things, I think the integration with the integration and synchronization with all the other warfighting functions, particularly fires, is what makes protection key and critical to what we're doing. The targeting process is a proven process. It's a very well ingrained process, and it ultimately allows staff to communicate risk to commanders. And this is an area where 337 continues to evolve. In the current version of 337, we have a very good description of the prioritized protection list, or the PPL. But as we've evolved, as Rich said, as the dialogue has continued, we've learned that the definition or the description of the PPL in current 337 probably needs a little bit of tweaking. In current 337, it's described as a little bit more of a static list. And you'll see that when you go out to a warfighter. You'll see that a unit's trying to protect a multi-role bridge company or this particular facility or that particular facility. And the challenge with that is we don't have enough protection assets on the battlefield to do what I call persistent protection. You can't protect everything. And so making that PPL, making that list active, making it activity-based or event-driven allows us to reevaluate those on a recurring basis. So it's as easy as instead of saying you're protecting a multi-role bridge company, the answer may be you're protecting that wet gap crossing from this time to allow X unit to pass. And then what it does is as a staff, it allows us to reframe the problem for our commanders, go back to a commander and say, sir, ma'am, here's the risk moving forward. Here's the risk to mission, risk to force. And senior leaders make decisions based off of risk. So if a staff is good at articulating that risk, then the senior commander can figure out, are they comfortable with the risk? Can they mitigate the risk? Do they need to get additional assets from higher? But all too often, if that PPL is static, you never get to that level of dialogue with the commander. So I think that's one of the key things that we have talked about. And again, the last thing I'll say on this is back to the integration with targeting, there are certain aspects of this that have to get in front of the commander. Every commander, every unit's going to do it different based on how that commander wants to fight his or her organization. But there's got to be a place where those critical decisions with targeting decisions are presented to the commander. The commander's ultimately got to assume the risk for his or her unit. And so we owe it to the commander to get the right decisions in front of them at the right time. And so that synchronization with targeting, again, through the depth and breadth of the battlefield. People often think of protection in the rear area. It's not just in the rear area. It's got to be synchronized with forward operations. It may be its own independent deep operation. The example I like to use is there may be a host nation bridge that's in place. Well, targeting's not going to account for that bridge. But if I don't have a capability that I'm thinking about with protecting it, we're not going to have that when we need it. So that PPL's got to be an active, activity-based, event-based document that becomes a fighting product that allows units to understand what their task and purpose is and commanders to understand where they may be assuming risk.
Building on that a little bit, those decisions that commanders make, commanders only got so much time. There's only so many decisions you can make. And so that's hugely important, particularly when we talk about scarce capabilities, air missile defense, CBRN, power engineer survivability assets. But then there's that broader category of specific actions, but they're specific that everybody should be taking. And you can link them to through mission analysis and the ops process, but it's really a training, leader development, and enforcement of standards in some cases, right? So if you link it to the imperatives of operations in a multi-domain environment, the first is see yourself, see the threat, and understand the OE. You know, what am I protecting against, and what do I have available to do that? What can I do by myself without asking for help? The other is accounting for that continuous observation, all forms of contact. And we added a new form of contact in terms of influence, right, through even at home station, social media, and so forth, that can influence our families, our soldiers. And then this other idea of making contact with the smallest force possible. And that really gets to making yourself hard to find and hard to kill, which gets to a planning piece of it, my tactics, how I come up with a scheme of maneuver, when I decide to move, the distances between my march serials, and then within the march serials, the distances behind my vehicle, how I want to execute timings, because they all create to it an opportunity for increasing the level of protection you have, and you're not using anything special to do it. You're using your head, and you're using discipline and operation security. You dig in, you know, if you're a dismounted soldier, you're using your E-tool, and you're digging in and camouflage your position every time you stop. And those things all get back to that cultural aspect, too.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. Protection synchronization has got to start with intelligence. What are you protecting from? Then it's got to include your EEFI and your FFIR. Why are you protecting it? What are you protecting? What's the threat? And then once you actually execute the mission, just like targeting, you've got to follow through with an assessment. Now, it may be an assessment that's with Blue. Pick up the phone and call the G4 and say, is the DSA been moved? Instead of using a PIR type asset. But the bottom line is the thought process has to be the same. It has to be a living, breathing process. It can't be something that, oh, I've briefed the boss on the PPL, and when he says index, then we'll look at what's next. As Rich can describe much better than I can across all warfighting functions, the biggest thing commands have to do at the senior levels is manage transitions. And if your protection team isn't looking at those transitions ahead of time, again, it all gets back to risk, and risk that the commander may not even know that he or she is assuming because we haven't communicated it correctly.
So do you think it would be helpful if we, you know, we used to have a red team university here. I think we reestablished some aspect of that. But this idea of looking at yourself, I mean, that's what you get to with that relationship of targeting and protection. But it's looking at yourself from the enemy perspective. And then the wider context is, what am I trying to do in the first place? You know, and where do I need to do it? And for how long do I need to be able to do it? And what do I want to look like on the other side? It's not going to be perfect, but that's what keeps you from outrunning your shore at umbrella, you know, when you decide to change phases of the operation or shift from the defense to the offense.
Rich, absolutely. You've got to be able to see yourself. Again, back to the ubiquitous sensing. The enemy's going to see you. So how do you eliminate their ability to understand you? How do you eliminate their ability to see a huge electromagnetic spectrum footprint that says, oh, that must be something important. That's a brigade or a division talk, whereas otherwise it's white noise.
You know, EEFI, essential elements of friendly information, the things you want to conceal from the enemy, that kind of had gone away from doctrine. We officially dropped it out of the commander's critical information requirements. But the senior leaders were very supportive of us bringing that back and emphasizing it, because you can't talk about this without talking about that. And since we already had a model that used to work in the old days pretty well, why not bring it back? And then the emission control levels, which we stole from the Navy. But if they have the same problems we have. In fact, it's probably a lot harder to hide on top of the water than it is in the terrain on land. So we borrowed that from them too, all to the points that you're making.
Sir, you talked a lot about risk assessments and the commanders informing the staff. As you've seen on different exercises, where have staffs gone right and staffs gone wrong with risk acceptance and letting the command know where he's taking risk?
So I've seen a couple different examples, and I think it really, the right versus wrong gets back to understanding levels of risk. it really gets back to understanding where is the level of risk that I can assume as a subordinate commander versus the level of risk that I am imparting upon my boss. And that's a really challenging relationship. It comes over time, it comes with trust, and it comes with the ability to clearly articulate to your boss, this is where I think I'm overstepping what I can say yes to or what I can mitigate. The reality is, if we do the PPL, if we do the protection process correctly, similar to the targeting process, what we will understand is, again, what are we trying to protect, from what, why, to achieve what outcome, and are we or can we be successful? And I think that quickly, in an environment like this, it quickly gets to the point where, okay, if we're talking multi-domain assets that are outside of the division or core, well, that's obviously something I've got to bring up to my commander. So not everything is that black and white by any stretch, but I think it's got to start with, first of all, you've got to understand risk at your level. The challenge we have is if you don't understand the risk, then you downplay it right away. You don't ever communicate it. Either you don't understand it's your level or you don't communicate it up to your senior level. So it's got to start with an understanding. You've got to understand the framework that you're trying to fight in and what that risk means to your force and your mission.
I think just a simple question, right? So we have task condition standards when we go and do unit collective training and then even down to individual training. But it's almost like you would stick a question in every one of those TEOs outlines for each unit type, you know, at each echelon. And instead of saying, did the unit do this? You could actually broadly, what are you doing to improve your protection during this activity, during the execution of this task? What measures have you taken to preserve combat power, to preserve operation security, to contribute to deception? Because the things you do for protection enable deception. Because those two things, you can't have one without the other. So, I mean, I think we could be, without spending any money, simply just by a verbal order, say, add that to when we talk course of action development in the classroom, or we talk after action reviews at a combat training center, an MCTP warfighter. I think it would really create some interesting conversations.
The reality with protection, and frankly, I think the reason we've been successful in evolving the dialogue so much in last year is it had to start with things like doctrine, things like leader development and training, because we didn't have a common understanding across the force. And we're not there yet. We're still making progress. As you know, we were able to get an elective into the War College. We're looking to get something into CCC across all the footprint. And we're trying to start hard with our Protection Integrators course to just get that common understanding. But I think you're 100% right. The reality with protection is, whether it's a peer, near-peer threat, they have capabilities that some we are going to outpace and some we won't. But if we think about protection differently, yes, we have some gaps across material and some other aspects, organization, that we're working on. But I think you're 100% right. If we really think about that mindset and think about it from the most junior person all the way up, we can have a significant positive effect on the battlefield today, now, without some of those material advances that we're working through.
And I think we do a shout out to the Non-Commissioned Officer Corps, right? Because convenience and comfort kill, and it's going to be the Non-Commissioned Officer Corps to a very large extent that's going to be forcing people to do the work, because all the things we're talking about generally involve more work than we were doing before.
I couldn't agree more. Colonel Aquino with MCTP says it really well. He said, you know, he's talked to his sergeant major. This starts with that NCO. This starts with them enabling success.
So when we're innovating capabilities for protection, the team has a huge job in considering requirements for every type of unit, as well as considerations for modernization efforts and how they fit into protection. How is the Maneuver Support Center of Excellence accomplishing this?
So that's a really good question, and I will tell you, I'll sarcastically say we're not. And what I mean by that is there are certainly some material gaps that we're working on. There are some organizational and people gaps that we're working on at the Maneuver Support Center. But back to where we started with, this is everybody's responsibility. I'll use counter UAS because that's a really important topic right now. We're not the proponent for that. The fire center is. But what's really impressive right now across CAC and TRADOC and frankly the Army is the teamwork approach. We all realize that whether it's transform in contact, deliberate transformation, or whatever the time horizon is, We have resource constraints. We have people constraints. And so everybody is looking at this as a holistic problem set to solve. And I'll speak across CAC because that's where I'm familiar with. The cross-coordination and synchronization between the centers of excellence right now is A, incredibly required, but B, incredibly powerful. CAC is coordinating a lot of discussions that we probably didn't have historically that we absolutely have to. So to your answer, there are things that we're working on at MISCO. Again, I'm very focused right now on PME because that's what I can affect in the near term while we continue to articulate risk to senior leaders about critical materiel gaps that we have and the protection brigade and what that looks like in the future. But my battle buddies to my left and right are moving forward with things just as quickly as I'm moving forward with things that are helping them.
Yeah, it's almost like a multilateral and bilateral relationship, right? Because on certain topics, you got to go, I mean, it's really, every branch proponent should be thinking about the protection aspects of what that branch is supposed to do. So to expect the Maneuver Support Center to tell the Maneuver Center what their camouflage systems would look like, that's not how it works. But at some point, though, there's got to be an agreement on the material solutions that can be applicable to a big army. Everybody doesn't have their own thing. They just have things that can be adapted across the different branches, the different platforms, soldiers in different environments, and so forth. So we have to champion for each other, right? We all have to champion protection, but then we have to champion specific types of outcomes for specific communities as well. But I think you're right, sir. I think starting in PME, a common understanding and the common situation awareness of what's expected makes that other, that relationship amongst the COEs and then the institutional operational force too. I think that's what enables it. Without that shared understanding, I think we're sunk before we even start.
No, I think you're exactly right. Our junior officers, our NCOs right now, you know, they've all got to understand protection enough to talk about it, understand what their role is. They all have to understand things like the electromagnetic spectrum. They all have to understand those basic capabilities so that when they get out to the operational force, they're able to communicate with their battle buddy to the left and the right. It's not about anymore, I'm an engineer, therefore that's all I worry about. And whether it's materiel, doctrine, training, you're 100% right. We've got to be able to communicate with one another because it's going to take a combined arms effort. It's going to take a joint force. It's going to take multinational partners for us to be successful.
Continuing on the individual protection question line. So when we're thinking about individual protection, we're also thinking about now emissions and friendly and cyber effects. How are we framing the discussion so that individual soldiers and your captains and lieutenants are thinking about these things when they're in the field, when they're doing exercises?
So that's a really good question that I don't think we've completely nailed down yet. Part of our challenge is twofold. Part of it is leader development in that our senior leaders, our functional leaders have to understand they own their function, but they also have to understand how they fit into something like protection. And those two aren't always the same thing because what you bring to protection, again, is based on the threat, based on what you're trying to protect, why, and that may be a small piece of what you as a functional organization do. So you've got to be able to wear both those hats. And then the other piece to it is not only do all of us own it, but particularly when you look at individual aspects, it's understanding the effect and the capability. We were talking today with space-based forces. There's a lot of those things that, frankly, a lot of our Army doesn't understand for various reasons. But the reality is when it's a value-added discussion is when that expert comes and says, I don't need to know the name of it. I don't need to know the nomenclature, but I can help you create this effect through this capability. And it's not just space, it's all those capabilities. Frankly, it's engineers as much as anybody else. It's the ability to communicate with another branch, another regiment, and be sure that, again, they understand the basics of, okay, that's what I can expect from them. When I was a lieutenant, as an engineer, people would always say, don't tell me you need a dozer, tell me you need a hole dug, and I'll figure out the best piece of equipment. It's no different today than it was back then. It's just some of the capabilities are a little bit more exquisite.
What do you think, sir, about, so I had one of the retired four stars, he described in the 1980s as we stood up the combat training centers and we were an Army that was still trying to get more professional at trying to do the same things we're trying to do now. So early 1980s. They discovered that during the training events, if your vehicle got killed, we're talking tanks in this case, then I'm out, so I can take a nap, right? So people would lay out on the back deck and sunshine. And they realized, okay, we got the wrong incentives in place here for that. Because in wartime, in battle, the lessons you learn about protection, unfortunately, are come at the cost of casualties and deaths. So what do we do in training to make things a little bit painful enough? And I'm not really asking you for an answer, because neither one of us is in a position to do this, and we'll probably become very unpopular. But there's got to be some penalties for non-compliance. I'm not talking UCMJ or anything else, but there's got to be something in terms of retraining to say, hey, guys and gals, you need to understand how important this is. Because if you get this wrong, you're not getting a casualty card and get to stand around for a couple of hours until we're time to start the next battle during training. And so what they did in the 1980s, anyways, back to that story, is they discovered if you told people to take out their entrenching tools and tanks each have picks and shovels on them too, you got to start digging in your tank. And until the battle's over, you need to be outside digging a hole and digging in your vehicle by yourself. And then we'll tell you when you can stop. And after doing that for a couple hours in the Mojave Desert, the message got out and people were like, okay, we got it. We're going to take this stuff seriously.
So, Rich, you immediately took me back to the early 90s as a second lieutenant. My second rotation in JRTC, I went with a brigade from the 101st. So my mechanized platoon, obviously I was attached to them. My mechanized platoon, I had more mobility assets in my platoon plus than they had the entire BCT or brigade at the time. And I just remember, because I kept thinking about, they did an air assault into somewhere in the box. And I remember it was about halfway through the rotation, and I drove by a squad that had air assaulted in and been completely cut off. They hadn't eaten in like 3 days. They weren't sleeping. And I just remember thinking, I think they're getting a little training value out of this. So I think your point is extremely valid. And again, I'll go back to a point you made a couple of minutes ago. That's what's going to start that, and what's going to drive that is our NCOs. Right. I think your point is so spot on. It's building that culture of you can survive on the battlefield, but it's not going to happen just because you wish it to. And so we have the capabilities as an Army. We have the capabilities to fight a near peer, to fight a peer threat, but it's got to start with a mindset. Are you there to take care of yourself and your team and your equipment? And that starts, frankly, our NCOs will drive that home.
I mean, I think every other Delta company in the Army was called Die Hard, right? But I'm not sure people understood what that meant. When you say somebody's a Die Hard, that means you're hard to find and you're hard to kill. And you ain't going easy. So this is about not making it easy. And I think when people get that, it's actually kind of cool, right? I mean, you're like, hey, I'm not going easy. I got to make this hard for you guys.
Yep.
And then we're going to bring it to you. But I got to make it hard for you first before I can bring the hurt to you.
You're 100% right.
Those are all doctrinal terms.
if you survive on the battlefield, you are going to be successful. But in today's environment, in today's OE, you will not survive if you're not deliberate about it.
Over the past 25 years, air defense units have provided key protection capabilities all around the world, and they're only looking to expand this mission with counter-UAS and other short-range requirements. But as we focus on air defense, what are some other protection tasks that you see as underserved or needing more attention across the enterprise?
Absolutely. And so I'm glad you brought up air defense. So I was very honored to have the opportunity to speak at the FIRE Symposium about 6 months ago. And I opened up my panel remarks with, I'm here to tell the air defense community they're moving to Fort Leonard Wood. You can imagine how well those comments went. But the point I make, and I'll start with air defense, then go to other areas. I was rhetorically asked the question, should air defense be part of maneuver support with protection, or should it be part of fires? And I said, it should absolutely be part of fires. The synchronization our Army gets by making them part of fires is significant. But the bigger synchronization, and I say bigger because it's not just air defense. everything plays into protection. And so, yes, air defense has got to play into that, just like cyber, just like space, just like sustainment and EOD. So the underserved areas, I would tell you, are largely our non-kinetic areas. We still struggle with how do we understand those capabilities? How do we bring them to bear at the right place and right time? And frankly, what do we have the authority for? Because most commanders, and I completely understand this thought process, if they have a limited non-kinetic asset from higher, they are probably going to use that to shape the battlefield forward. But again, back to that risk discussion, if the protection team has thought about that and they present that to the commander, it may or may not shift their calculus, but at least then they'll understand the risk that they're assuming with however they're going to use that limited resource. So I think absolutely, I would tell you integration of non-kinetic assets is where we have to continually refine our approach within protection and ensure that everybody understands the capabilities that those exquisite assets bring to the fight.
We've been working with some other communities and largely your team to make sure that we are addressing in doctrine that's not protection focused, but that broadly applicable doctrine, like an FM3O and some other ones. Chemical defense, because again, that's a cultural aspect to it. I mean, we have kit for it, but we don't have time necessarily to train that as often as we'd like. Certainly not as much as we did during the Cold War. Operations in a nuclear environment, something we've been working with your team in USICA on, because that acronym CBRNE kind of hides in some ways what the two major things that you really got to be able to worry about, because the game's not over just because the enemy uses chemical weapons or tactical nuclear weapons. And then survivability. And we've joked about that, you know, already this afternoon a little bit. But that's the one thing that almost anybody can do themselves just by thinking about how do I make myself harder to kill. And I think, and we use that example with a lot of the audiences, but we were part of an army that on the tail end of that culture was still there, but an army in 1970, 53, 45, 1918, even 1865 understood that nobody was going to come take care of that for you. And your experiences as an engineer officer, yeah, you did have capabilities to do that, but you weren't doing it for everybody. You were doing it for the people that had no ability to put a tank in turret defilade or Bradley in turret defilade or to dig in a command post, right? That's the exception. I mean, the reality was everybody else was on their own, and they better start filling sandbags, digging a hole, putting in some overhead cover, those kinds of things. And we've had excuses not to do that at home station in some cases, right? Oh, we're not allowed to dig because of environmental considerations and all that. And we've all been on installations and both overseas and the U.S. where people will tell you that. And then when you go and dig into it, it's actually not true. You can do it. You just have to do the work, the staff work to make that happen. I don't know whether that's cultural or that's policy or just enforcement. Sometimes I'm wondering if we just don't always teach people why, you know, when you tell people why you do that, and give them demonstrations. You remember they used to give demonstrations where, you know, they drop a 105 round on top of a bunker that was dug to standard versus one that wasn't, or a mortar round, where you had the tables and the engineers were the keeper of this stuff, right? How much packed snow stops a 30 caliber round? Or a 50 caliber round, how much overhead cover do you need? I mean, that's all math and science stuff, right? Because it's all physics. But I think that's a growth area. And it is sort of specialized, but that's not something you learn in the classroom. That is something you actually have to go out and do.
So when we talk protection, we talk preserve, deny, enable. Preserve our critical capabilities, assets, and activities. Deny the enemy's capability to impact us with things like A2AD and enable our freedom to maneuver. And I would absolutely put everything you just said in preserve. And again, back to where we started with the dialogue, protection is everybody's business. There aren't enough assets on the battlefield for persistent protection. And so everybody's got to be looking up for that UAS threat. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got to be digging themselves in when you come to a halt. And I think your CBRNE example is an awesome one. I just saw some training at our, where we're the home of Seaburn, some squads, we just ran through it, the basics of masking and unmasking procedures, mop gear exchange. We have atrophied in those skills, and you could pick any regiment and pick the basics, and we've atrophied in those.
Sure.
And so you're right. We've got to ensure that we are capable of doing those basic blocking and tackling, because if we can do those at the individual level, then it's much easier for us to synchronize at the unit level and higher level, those operational capabilities. But if we can't do those individual tasks that you're talking about, it's going to be game over a whole lot quicker.
As we record this, we're just 2 months into the current CGSC class at the Lewis and Clark Center, and students are starting to sign up for electives. Do you have any general comments or advice for them, and why should they take the protection elective?
I appreciate you bringing that up. So we just finished our first annual Protection Senior Leader Forum, and the purpose of that was to show senior leaders from a protection perspective what we can do now, what we think we can do in the near future, and where we may be assuming risk in a little bit further out. And I would tell folks, and I had the opportunity last CGSC to talk to the students in the elective, which is the first one. And I think the biggest benefit you get, or the two benefits that I would challenge folks to think about taking it, number one, you learn that it's everybody's business. It's not just MPs, engineers, Seaburn. It's everybody's business. And you also learn, and I'll steal from Mr. Creed, the art and science. You learn more about the art of protection, because protection, I would tell you, there's not a formula. You're not going to put 10 things in, it's going to spit out on the other end, go dig this deep. It's going to give you the thought process of how, what questions are you asking? Who are you bringing into the dialogue to enable the most effective protection synchronization that you can? And that's what I would challenge students to think about when they take it, but also why to take it. When you're in CGSC and you're either a field grade or going to transition soon to be one, when you get to your next unit, you're now the they. You're the person that's got to think about what is it that we're trying to accomplish. You're beyond the point where I put A in and B comes out. And you're getting ready for that operational level leadership, that organizational level leadership. And you got to think about that art aspect of it. And I think that's really the biggest thing that when I spoke to the instructors of the course that we're trying to get out of this is think about how, think about why, think about what we're protecting. Don't think about the formula, because if that's what you're thinking about, you're going to hold a piece of paper up and brief your senior leader, and you're not even going to understand why you're in MOP 2 right now. You just know the calculator spit out, you're supposed to be in MOP 2. So you're going to tell the commander it's time to go to MOP 2. And you're going to get shot. But I really think that's the biggest thing that I would say. It's and then the other piece is, after you take the elective, tell us what worked. Tell us what didn't work. We're only as relevant as the feedback we get, whether it's on doctrine or anything else we're doing. And so we ask people all the time, and this is why we're so aggressive in going out to CTCs and MCTP work. We want to see what's working and what's not working. We want to be sure that what we're thinking is what the OC teams are seeing, what the senior mentors are seeing, what the units are seeing, so that we can put all that back together and then push back out to the operational force. Hey, here's what we're seeing that works. Here's what we're changing our thought process on so that our PME is relevant tomorrow based on what units are seeing today, not relevant 3 years from now based on what units are seeing today.
How much of the POI gets influenced by, you know, world events or current events or observations? I know, I'm sure they tie in the call, and Center for Army Lessons Learned pretty closely, but there's an awful lot of information out there that's open source, and I bet you maybe the initial concept for the course has probably changed, I would think, based on observations in Nagorno-Karabakh and Gaza and Ukraine.
That's a great question, and I will tell you that's a focus area from General Beagle to all of the COEs. When I look at the PIC course, the Protection Integrators course, the POI that we got approved for that was about a year and a half old. You know as well as I do, the evolution of protection dialogue in the last year makes almost all of that POI irrelevant. So we're trying to be sure that we're bringing back lessons from every single iteration, whether it's a lesson plan change, whether it's frankly just the SGLs talking to the team and saying, this is what I'm seeing in the OE. So we're getting a lot from call. We're getting a lot from quickfire. We're getting a lot from things like SAGU. We talk to the Pacific a lot. the connective tissue between the generating or institutional force and the operating force right now, I think, is really good. And I think the operating force understands that they own a large piece of making sure that we're relevant in what we're doing. So what you described is absolutely 100% a key focus area for all of us right now.
Unlike other warfighting functions, you see sometimes a reluctance to say, well, that worked over there for those armies, you know, it was very different. We would do things differently. I would argue you might be able to make that argument about some warfighting functions. I'm not sure you can make that argument about protection. I think protection, the way we think about it, has got to be informed by real-world examples right in front of your face. And I don't care who's doing it. It may not look exactly the same, and we may be doing it in a different place, but those dynamics don't change. I don't think they change at all. They can go from observations to trends to lessons to doctrine really fast if they had to.
I absolutely agree. So, I couldn't agree more. And General Beagle, he quotes these all the time to me. So in 337, we have the principles of protection, and they're comprehensive, integrated, redundant, layered, and enduring. And I had to look at my notes just to be sure I didn't screw up, because he knows them. And he and I were talking today, and he said, yep, they're applicable across everything we do. So, you know, back to preserve, deny, enable, back to foundational, operational. The how may change a little bit based on theater, but the mindset absolutely has got to be consistent.
Thank you, gentlemen, for the discussion on this vital topic and helping to frame the problem and our efforts to protect the force in MDO and LISCO environments. So thank you again, Major Albeck, and thank you, Mr. Creed, for this discussion.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thanks, Nate.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Really appreciate this.
Yeah, thanks for coming, sir. This is a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just like writing doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew in Special Doctrine Division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you our show. The executive producer of Breaking Doctrine is Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by Mr. Zarek Fry of 29 Pixel Studios. Please don't forget to subscribe on Google, Apple, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on the newest podcast, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I am Lieutenant Colonel Nate Rice, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.